If you open up the conversation about yourself or about an incident, remember that time where you were on holiday, Dad, and you got a concussion? I want us to make sure we have a plan for if something like that happens again. So it's not necessarily about the idea that you are old and thus dependent, thus frail, but it's more about the fact that you live a life and things happen in your life. And let's make a plan for those things together. That really changes the narrative.
Welcome to Coming of Age, a podcast that is changing the conversation on aging. I'm your host, Donna Duncan, CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association. This season, season 4 of Coming of Age, we welcome an exciting roster of guests from around the world, thought leaders who are at the forefront of transforming seniors' living and care and are shaping the future for all of us as we age. In this episode, we're exploring a topic that many of us face, but few are prepared for: how to have essential conversations with our aging parents about their health, care needs, and life transitions. Joining me is Laura Tamblyn Watts, the CEO of CanAge, a leading seniors advocacy organization in Canada. Laura's multifaceted career spans law, academia, and policy development, reflecting her dedication to impactful advocacy and education. And this year, she added author to her biography. Laura's recent book, Let's Talk About Aging Parents, provides invaluable guidance for those in their 30s through their 70s, reflecting the diverse demographics of caregivers today. With practical insights on 27 key topics, Laura's book covers everything from managing home care and financial planning to discussing sensitive issues like downsizing and long-term care. So whether you're just beginning this journey or are deep into it, this episode offers the support and guidance to face these challenges with confidence. Let's dive in. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Point Click Care. So welcome, everybody. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome a repeat participant on today's podcast. Laura, welcome to our podcast. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Laura, since we last spoke with you in the middle of the pandemic in Canada, you took the time to write a book. Let's Talk About Aging Parents, a real-life guide to solving problems with 27 essential conversations. What motivated you, inspired you to write this book?
I think like so many of us, there's a lot of lessons that we have learned that I wish we could sort of share to people more quickly. And I'd thought about writing the book before, and indeed, I had promised to write the book. And then I got a call from the agent saying, you really got to write it right now. And Donna, I know that you and I and so many of your listeners were at the very, very front lines of the pandemic. It was 24/7. It was absolutely critical that we be focused and we make sure that we are paying as much attention to what was happening in the crisis as we possibly could. Having said that, there was never a time more compelling to try to help people in their individual lives. A lot of what we do are system change pieces. This is all the stuff that you need to know when you are having someone in a relationship with you who kind of needs help, whether they know it or not. I use the term aging parents and adult children, and it's big disclaimers all over the place. This is a slang, it's a short form for really anyone, whether it's family of choice, family of kin, whether it's a neighbor or friend, whether it is your great aunt twice removed, somehow, however it is, it's really just about people and relationships with each other.
Well, it's such a great point in terms of the people with whom we need to have these conversations. And more than ever before, we have people like me who have no children. And I'm in the process right now with a number of chosen family members where we're doing estate and care planning for an older couple who are friends of my mom and dad's who have no children either. And it's unusual for us to now to start to be having conversations, one, with people who are in their 80s, starting to have those conversations about some very key things that and big issues that you raise in your book. So you talk about money, mental health, housing, care, sexual health. You talk about having those bigger discussions around planning. How do you unlock them, and how can we unlock them sooner?
I think about conversations as both just in time, sometimes later than you wish in the just in time, and also the advanced ones. I think it's got to be okay that we don't always do things perfectly. The book is actually structured on the real, and I use the term family again with quotation marks around that, the real people, as opposed to kind of a 1950s idealized mom, dad, and two kids who live this sort of perfect existence. That's actually not how people are. And I think the more that we hang on to that narrative, the less actually we get done. That same thing about unfreezing people from that deer in the headlights fear that folks have. Fair enough. Will I have enough money? What will my health be like? Am I going to get dementia? What is this thing called long-term care? And what do we mean by that anyway, right? And because the issues are so big and we're framing them to be so frightening, I think that that planning part is really hard, except for people who really love to plan. And sometimes they love to plan one thing, but mostly not everything, right? Some people like to plan finance, but they will not plan health or care. Some will plan about their social or travel, but they won't figure out how they'll manage if they fall and break a hip and things go wrong. So this book is funny. First of all, you need to know it's funny and it is just in time. You can reach over at 3 a.m., open a chapter, what to do about the fact that dad probably shouldn't be driving anymore. By the way, that's the last chapter, so it's easily found. It is about we're having a crisis because mom had a stroke, but actually I know that that's just one person in my life that we need to think about. What about the fact that actually many, many people don't have children? Or if they have children, maybe those are not the best people anyway. What if you got mental health in the family? You're normal. What about the fact that you actually hate your parents? Yeah, more normal than one might imagine. And so the book allows us to laugh, but allows us to start conversations. And there's different even scripts, depending on what your parent or what you were like. And again, parent with all of the provisos that it's not necessarily your biological parent.
Well, what I really love about the book, Laura, and for our audience, it really is funny. You bring joy and humor to this, but you also present a really accessible roadmap for families to plan. And it really is a great guidebook. And I really want to thank you and congratulate you on that, because it is something that we really do need. Some of the research that we've done through the Ontario Long-Term Care Association and surveying baby boomers in Ontario, Canada, we found that especially the younger baby boomers, they don't actually want to talk about aging. They have not planned for aging. They have not had conversations with their kids. And in fact, they don't expect their kids to look after them, and they don't want their kids to look after them, which I think raises some very interesting considerations, because there is this blind faith that the system will just take care of them. And I think you and I both know, it doesn't matter wherever we are in the world, and none of us has actually figured this out. And so I'm really curious, how do you start those conversations that no one actually wants to have?
I think one of the most important things is to start understanding how people are, what they react well to, and what they don't react well to. I have never yet found anyone that reacts well to somebody often younger coming in and saying, hey, I'm going to do this thing for you. In fact, I don't think that you know what you're doing, and I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. Not so much. And that doesn't work especially well if they are your parents or someone who's raised you. This myth that somehow you become the parent to your parents is just that. That is a myth. Your parents always think of you probably as some kind of 16-year-old that left your smelly sports socks or maybe crashed the car, right? It's important to remember that those relationships actually don't change. But I think we get ourselves in trouble. So one of the most helpful pieces of advice I can give people is start with yourself. When I wanted to get my dad, mid-80s, mom, mid-80s, to read you or look at their planning documents, I did not find any success saying, hey, let's look at your will. Hey, I want to just check out your powers of attorney. None of that worked. What did work eventually was me sitting down and saying, you know what, dad? You're a lawyer. You're my dad. You've been doing this for a while. I'm really thinking I probably need to refresh some of that stuff. I'd love your advice. I'd love your advice. Can I talk something through with you? I'm trying to figure it out. What also works, thinking about things that are not necessarily age-based related, and this is especially true of baby boomers, but are incident related. So my friend, you know, was playing fill in the sport, tennis, volleyball, pickleball probably these days, right? Whenever they're playing, hiking down a mountain, and they broke their ankle. They hurt their hip. They dislocated their shoulder. I remember that time where I fill in the blank. Then I got thinking to myself, what would I do if? And that led me to think about what would we all do if? So I'm going to try to do some planning, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, you know, auntie, uncle, neighbor next door. And I'd really, really appreciate it if we could kind of make a plan together. Because what would happen with the kids? What would happen with the dog or the cat or the whatever else? If you open up the conversation about yourself or about an incident, remember that time where you were on holiday, dad, and you got a concussion? I want us to make sure we have a plan for if something like that happens again. So it's not necessarily about the idea that you are old and thus dependent, thus frail, but it's more about the fact that you live a life and things happen in your life. And let's make a plan for those things together. That really changes the narrative.
To that point, as we know across Canada, we have a lot of individuals living in remote communities, rural communities, even those who live in Toronto, their kids have moved away. I think one of my sisters, her son lives in the Netherlands. They're in rural Ontario, and so their son's not here to look after them. As we think about those dynamics, how should an individual approach putting somebody on point? So for instance, in our family, there are three sisters. I was the one who was coached and supported by my mother in estate planning, becoming her executor. I was the one who, it was always understood, was going to play that role because I was closest to home. And I actually think that really helped navigate some of the family dynamics because we all knew, and my mother shared that with all of us. And so I'm just curious, how should families have those family conversations, not just child to parent or parent to child or grandparent or neighbor, so that there is clarity around some of those roles and responsibilities and that we know where the duty will rest, including how there may be a shared duty.
This is one of the most important things that you can do. I have entire chapters on helping to navigate and think through things. One of the things I had expected is that, I'll call them siblings for lack of a better term, right? Like adult siblings, whether they be what actually relationship they are to each other is their own business. But I had expected someone to buy the book for like the other five and say, you know, read chapter 9, then like, let me know. I'd expected that. And happily, that is what happened. What I hadn't expected, and in some ways is even more fantastic, is that older adults are buying it for the people who are in their network and actually giving it to them and using the book as an expression of what they want without having to educate everybody. Here's an example. When you're thinking about being a substitute decision maker, so wherever you are in the world, there's going to be some kind of document, usually called something like a power of attorney. We have them all across the country and globally as well. But lots of people don't know who to choose, or they're really worried about choosing and offending somebody else. So it helps you kind of go through the fact that, frankly, it's a terrible job. It is actually a terrible job. And it helps people think through, you know, don't pick the kid who faints at the sight of blood to be your decision maker for healthcare or who hates hospitals. Don't pick the child who can't do numbers or has a hard time filing their own taxes, by the way, no judgment, I'm just saying, you know, pick the person who is well-suited, and it may not be a relative at all. It can help you think through what that job is, and then even ask, like, do you want that job to people? You'd be amazed once the job is described and what the obligations are. You're going to be my power of attorney for personal care. That means you have to keep an entirely separate set of accounts, that you have to do trust accounting, that you actually have to do those things annually. If somebody who is in this connected area around me, friends and so on, who might want to challenge it, you have to produce the accounts. You could be called to court. If you do it wrong, there could be criminal charges against you. Like, it's amazing anyone does the job, frankly. So helping to unpack it in a kind of funny way, as I do in the book, is useful. It also helps you think through the real reality, as you've talked about. In Ontario, and actually this is pretty similar to other jurisdictions, the average distance between, I'll call close family, to an aging parent is about 400 kilometers on average. And if you're out of jurisdiction, but still in the country, it's about 2,100 kilometers. So this is the norm, if there even is anybody, right? Even if there is anybody. So when you're thinking about it, it's also helpful to understand, you know, where can technology help? So right now, actually running someone's finances from a distance is not that hard. It's not perfect, but it's not that hard. But trying to make decisions for somebody else about their body, you got to be close by. And so unpacking what the jobs are and then trying to figure out who makes most sense. But for that stuff about your body, you better be close by. And sometimes that makes sense to people. If you understand the rationale and the needs and the obligations, then you can help to get rid of that worry about offending people.
No, I think that's such a great point. And again, for our listeners, I highly recommend the way you frame this in your book. Laura, we know that most people want to age at home. If someone requires more specialized care and cannot age in their family home, is that failure? And whose failure is it?
I think it's a failure of understanding our own selves. And I think it's a failure of understanding the system. In many ways, it is a failure because of optimism. That makes any sense. Nobody thinks they're going to need help, and nobody thinks they're going to get hurt, and nobody believes they're going to become frail, right? This is especially true of the baby boomers. And so this whole narrative around healthy aging or positive aging actually makes my teeth ache, because it then makes you a failure if you actually do need long-term care, which like 20% of older Canadians will, right? You then are a failure because you haven't aged positively enough or healthily enough. I mean, it's ludicrous, right? I think what we need to do is have a confronting of the reality. The book tries to do it with humor and love and, you know, a dose of smile as much as a dose of a wake-up kind of caffeine jolt, right? That you got to make a plan. In the same way that you got to make a plan if you fall down the stairs and break your hip at any age. But some of the realities of the circumstances are, if you fall down and break a hip at 85, your chances of easily recovering from that are few. And your chances of needing long-term care as a result are high. It's not a failure of healthily aging. You didn't, you know, lose the competition, right? I think we need to understand chunks of people are going to need chunks of things. To say everyone's going to age in place is fine, if you, as long as you have a broad understanding what place means.
Exactly. And we're certainly of the view that aging in a long-term care home is aging in your community, and that we need to consider that different forms of housing and supports are going to be really important for us as we all age.
And aging in place can also mean a different place. It means if you, for instance, have a connection to another community, and right now you're living in a rural community and you just can't manage there any longer. For me, aging in place means having as well that option in that one community in the urban environment that you would be happy to go to, as opposed to being forced someplace where you have no connections as well. So it's aging in place, as long as the place is a place of your connections and your relationships and your heart, as opposed to being displaced. It may not be in your family home. And frankly, you may actually decide that you want that, because you hear that narrative all the time. I want to stay in the family home, and I want to stay in the family home. I actually didn't. Like, I took my own darn advice, Donna. I sold the family home this year when the kids got you know, on their own, theoretically, one hopes. And we moved into a downtown environment. We downsized, and we are now walking distance to almost absolutely everything that we need, including medical care, hospital care, and other forms of care, including long-term care. Because I knew that for me, aging in place meant I got to get myself ready to be in a place where there's more connection. If I was in a rural community, I need to have a slightly different conversation. If I want to age in that rural community, I need to be thinking, okay, how can I make maybe a naturally occurring retirement community? Where can I share services with neighbors? What systems are close by for transportation, which is often the thing that really gets you, is actually transportation. Sometimes healthcare isn't such a problem as long as you can get to the healthcare an hour away, but many people can't. So aging in place is more of a mindset, and it shouldn't be a see no evil, hear no evil, and I'm not going to plan. No, quite the contrary. You have to do more planning and have a better sense of place.
And to find that sense of agency, to your point, sooner than later. So have those discussions early, make those plans early, and find your own control within that space.
And I think that as we are aging, the key reality is we lose people, whether we lose them because they go far away, which is, you know, not necessarily a bad thing, but we lose them out of our, you know, coffee connection, as I call it. If you can't call somebody up and go for coffee, they're not close enough to you for many kinds of quick response. I mean, you can go for coffee maybe an hour away, but you're probably not going for coffee by getting on a plane and flying for 7 hours, right? Your coffee connections. And, you know, one of the things I think we're seeing as we're having more and more solo agers is that people are prioritizing their own networks. And that's where you see kind of that Golden Girls model, whether or not they buy different houses and share a backyard, whether you purchase a big house together and divide it up into suites and share services, or whether you take it into that kind of naturally occurring retirement community, but not really naturally occurring, actually purposeful community, where you come and you say, you know, these three couples, these two solo seniors, this, you know, multi-generational family, we're gonna build a place and a space that we could get each other help if we needed to, as well as go for coffee. And I think that that's really interesting. As we're reflecting on the diversity and different cultural and social norms associated with it, that fits very nicely into either multi-generational living or close connection communities. It's really so much about who do you have in your life and who do you have close by to enrich your life? And being alone in that big family house in an urban environment where everybody else has moved away may not be that ideal of aging in place. Maybe aging in place is making clearer decisions about how to be close to your coffee connection community.
What we're certainly seeing being built out in terms of physical space in Ontario, Canada, whether that's on the campus of Trent University with a partnership between People Care and Trent, whether that's a village community hub or a municipal home or another nonprofit home, what we're seeing is our members are building not just long-term care, they're building assisted living, independent living. They're building staff housing, key worker housing, employee housing. They're building student housing. They're having partnerships so that it's intergenerational. And just recently, having come back from the Netherlands, where we visited a number of dementia villages, what we're seeing evolve is not enclosing people in a dementia village, but keeping them integrated in their broader community with those other intergenerational supports and activities that bring them out into the community and normalize, whether they have dementia or other forms of frailty. We're starting to see a real shift. We're seeing a lot of innovation.
This is everything that we need to do, right? It's about making inclusive communities. And again, that aging in place is not necessarily only a physical location or a street number. It's where is your place in your society? Where is your place in your community that you can age? One of the best things I have seen is actually when companies take this up. Because actually, mostly we don't interact with the healthcare system all the time, right? Mostly we interact by going to the store or going for a walk in the park or these types of things. And we have this conversation around, you know, age-friendly communities and age-inclusive communities, and we're kind of getting to dementia-friendly stuff. All of that is evolving. What I am loving is starting to see the rise of neurodiversity awareness in companies and public-private spaces, because dementia is a type of neurodiversity. And so a lot of the same things that work for people with autism, people with ADHD, other forms of concussion or cognitive impairment, all of which are, by the way, very different from each other. But what it does allow us to do is have a sense of pause and understanding that everything in an environment doesn't work for everybody. And you put different ways that people want to interact with each other and kind of make it okay, then things start working. And many of the reasons why people do need to shift disappear.
It's such a great point. I think of when my father first presented with Alzheimer's back in the 1990s, and family and friends were afraid of him. His disease was invisible. They couldn't see anything, and they just didn't know how to communicate. And one of the things, again, within your book, you talk about how to have a conversation with someone with dementia. And I do think it's important for our listeners to fully appreciate, for those who aren't working in this space, that everyone presents differently. Not everyone is going to have really advanced, aggressive, end-stage dementia. Many will have more mild forms of dementia and will live fruitful lives, aging in their place, whatever their place may be. And it's not all loss. I remember taking my father to a McDonald's. We went for McDonald's breakfast, and he didn't know what a hash brown was. And he ate it with relish and joy. And I thought, imagine eating a McDonald's hash brown for the first time every time and finding joy in that moment. And I think how we validate the lives that have been, validate the people they have become in whatever form of dementia or care or aging, that there is no cookie cutter here. And that all we actually need is for people to be treated with respect and to be supported respectfully. So I love your framing of that. I'm going to get concrete on a specific issue that you do touch on in your book as well. And then I've got a big, hairy question I'm going to ask you about money and financial planning. You've talked about the importance of financial planning. People are living longer than ever today. When we think of the number of centenarians who are living in retirement communities, long-term care homes, people are living much, much longer. And I've had a number of discussions over the last number of months of people, of individuals who've moved into a retirement home or a new condominium, or they've changed their housing, but they're running out of money. And so what do families and other caregivers need to think about to ensure that whoever they're supporting actually does have the resources and that they're thinking about what a contingency plan might be?
Money is always one of those topics that we love to chide other people about, and actually often terrifies us, right? The reality of a circumstance is that most Canadians are going to be at some kind of risk of outliving their money. That is actually real if they imagine the kind of care that they want and they assume that that will get funded, right? Then they would. Because let me give you an example. If you want kind of a personal support worker, healthcare aide, somebody with some degree of training, I'm not talking a registered nurse or a doctor. I'm just talking about somebody with some kind of training helping you 24/7, which many people assume is going to happen with the quote aging in place model, right? I'll stay here as long as I want. I'll move in a personal support worker, or healthcare aide. They'll work in shifts and I get to stay here because that's aging in place, quote unquote, right? Great. As long as you've got about $10 million, because you're probably going to spend about $300,000 a year on that staffing, right? If you're going to then imagine out what that's going to be, $10 million, you have to think about your taxes and then think about how long you can live, right? And then usually you get the stunned look. It's okay. Now, aging is not a thing that our public system does. And healthcare was set up for acute care. You break a leg, they fix it for you, you go home, okay? And whether or not we can change our system fast enough to help, aging costs more than you think it does. And so you got to make a bit of a plan. And I try not to terrify people right away by saying too many stats about outliving your money and so on. I try to kind of approach it with a bit with humor, right? What is it that you want? What are we looking for, et cetera? And then you have to think about, okay, imagine you're planning a vacation. Okay, think about it. What kind of vacation do you really like? Oh, okay, well, I like the hiking kind, or I like the camping kind, or I like the 4-star, that's fine, or I want the super luxury kind. Great. Okay, that's fine. You might make some trade-offs if you're thinking about what your vacation is going to be. You might stay at a place that costs a little bit less to be in a better, in your mind, environment, and so on. So I ask people to think about vacation planning and their aging plan kind of the same way. Because probably unless you have a lot of money and a lot of help, you're probably making trade-offs. So let's figure out what's most important to you.
Well, that's such a great way of framing it. And it makes it less scary. I think we've demonized aging in a really unhealthy way. And every single one of us will age. And yet we have such a great opportunity to value those who are aging. And I love watching some of our members. They've been taking individual 99-year-olds on who have a bucket list and helping and supporting them through living their dreams. You're never too old to dare to dream. So my big hairy question on this planning, because one of the things we do here is, I'm going to age in place, and when my money runs out, I don't want to go to long-term care. My plan is, now that it's available in Canada, I'm going to use medically assisted aid in dying. And other countries, as the Netherlands, Switzerland, others, have euthanasia. It's an emerging debate in the United Kingdom and Scotland today. But we're hearing all too often that rather than grow old, and rather than plan to grow old or think about growing old, there seems to be this new line of thinking that I'm going to end my life.
And I think it's the same thing as my mother telling me that she wants me to find an ice floe to put her on, right? But I met her back with humor and I said, Mom, there's climate change. You know how hard it is to find an ice floe? Like, I can't find an ice floe anymore, right? So what I think is important about that from kind of I teach in the faculty of social work. So when I hear about that, I don't really think that there's this mass desire for suicide. And I use that word provocatively because I actually don't think they're talking about medical assisted dying. I think they're trying to talk about an ice floe or stage left, or I don't know what to do with my life, or I can't imagine being less well. So I lean in with my kind of social work self, not my lawyer self, which is going to go and answer, you know what? That's not medical assisted dying. Growing old is not a medical condition, right? So I hear it as a cry of frustration and worry and also kind of avoidance, right? That's what I hear it as. So I usually lean in with my social work hat and say, yeah, tell me a little bit about that. Like, where are you coming to about that? Or, you know, when you think about those things, what does that mean to you? Or, you know, is there a fear in here? And almost always, it's not that they actually want to exit stage left. It's that they want to be well and then dead. That they actually are avoiding the notion of pain or avoiding the notion of disease or avoiding the notion of dementia. Overwhelmingly, people are afraid of poverty and dementia. And that is okay that they say that, you know, my plan is to, you know, take whatever exit stage left version there is, and they're using the term medical assisted dying in that, but really to kind of unpack where their fears are and then to meet them at the place where their fears are and then to offer different choices. Many people say they never want to go into long-term care. And then I usually answer with, oh, you know, again, tell me all about that. And it usually falls into two categories. One, my mother, or fill in the blank, you know, had a bad experience, or my mother, father, sister, uncle, cousin, whatever, was in long-term care and dot, dot, dot. And often what they're seeing is they are looking at it through their eyes as a younger, able person, and they're imagining that they would not want that rhythm of their day. You're quite right. That would feel dissonant and odd, right? So I can understand that, meet that with empathy. But when you are 95 years old, that rhythm of the day is probably just fine. Right? I mean, people have abusive and terrible situations in all aspects of their life. I think it's important to note that, you know, that what you want at certain times is not what other people need at certain times. So I would meet it with that. The second one is they've never been into a long-term care home. So I hear that in almost the same expression as I want medical assistance in dying, right? I don't want to go to long-term care. And I say, tell me about that. In your mind, what are you imagining? And then all of a sudden we go to a village with an integrated environment, with seniors housing, with, you know, other levels of support, with a philosophy of transformative or emotion folk, right? COVID wasn't great for anyone. It was especially hard for people in long-term care. And the first people that would have told you how hard it was going to be were people who were living and working in long-term care. The reason why we had such a bad experience in long-term care is because nobody was listening to the people who were in and working in long-term care. We didn't do better. That's a failure of the society to listen to people in the long-term care system.
Well, you know, it's such a great point. And many of you will have heard me say this already. One of the privileges in Ontario, Canada today is that there was recognition for the need for change coming out of the pandemic. And Ontario has invested billions of dollars in renewing the infrastructure, building new modern long-term care homes, new models of care, new standards of care, new philosophies of care. And is there more work to do? Absolutely. But long-term care today, certainly in Ontario, is not what it was 5 years ago. But we need to look at different models of living, and we need to have these really important conversations that, Laura, you are raising awareness of. And we need to have them sooner and not be afraid.
And I think one of the calls that we have, and certainly since we're talking about Ontario, we're calling for it here, but actually we're calling for it across the country and for that matter, frankly, around the world, is we need to recognize that aging, population aging, which is, by the way, not a tsunami. As somebody who did live in a tsunami zone, anyone who calls it a silver tsunami doesn't know what a tsunami is. Tsunami is a thing that comes out of nowhere, is a giant wave that hits and then dissipates. That is exactly not what's happening with aging. We knew all about it. We just decided that it didn't somehow relate to us, or we didn't need to do anything, right? It was denial. If we think about the five mega trends that we talk about at the United Nations and the World Health Organization, population aging is one of those five megatrends. It's not going to go away. And so what we need to do is celebrate it as longevity, but we also don't have to have it as the idea of you are always going to be healthy at every part of your life and you're never going to need any assistance. That's just not true. We need assistance at different times. And, you know, it was Rosalind Carter who said there's only four kinds of people: the people who are caregivers, the people who have been caregivers, the people who will be caregivers, and people who need care. And I think if we take this life course and longevity approach and layer caregiving onto it, then we kind of relax a little bit. It's okay. Sometimes people are going to need a lot of care from a lot of folks, and other times they won't, and you might be giving it. It helps us to re-understand that communities can be built in all kinds of different situations, and we see that really well in our long-term care systems that get enough support. But Donna, when I think about what doesn't work is when you build things like structures for long-term care homes, but ministries or governments aren't looking at it across the government. And that means you don't have any people to work in them, because it's a different ministry to think about how people get trained. It's a different ministry to how people get in and out of the country if you're going to have immigration in that area. It's a different ministry again for X, Y, and Z. And so what I want us to do is to make sure that we have a cross-cutting theme across government. Yes, a senior strategy, but really an integrated senior strategy that says whenever we're doing analyses of anything or trying to put a priority together or have money, that we ask ourselves, how is this going to intersect with population aging? And that will tweak us, hopefully. So when you're building a long-term care home, that we don't just have a structure that doesn't have enough people to work there, or that doesn't have enough transit to help you get there, or that doesn't have enough trees and gardens and environmental sustainability so that people can have food from that local area. We need to think about it in an integrated approach.
Well, and that is something that the SCAN Foundation out of California has really been vested in. And so I will direct our listeners to an earlier podcast episode where we spoke with Katie Smith Sloan from Leading Age and the SCAN Foundation around cross-sectoral planning, where transportation is just as important as education. It's just as important as home and community care. It's just as important as mental health supports. It's just as important as those buildings that you're constructing. But the workforce and the informal caregivers that you spoke about at the top, Laura, whether that's chosen family, it's neighbors, it's friends, it's former colleagues, thinking about our collective responsibility for one another and those structures of government and funding structures really become barriers to change. And it's not an either or. It's not home and community care or long-term care. It's not primary care or long-term care or acute care. We're at this juncture where it's all of it. But how do we come together and think about how we're going to use those shared resources? So whether that's through technology, and we're talking about artificial intelligence, remote care models, robots, wearables, other kind of diagnostics. This really is a different world. And now we have focused ultrasound, and we've broken the blood-brain barrier at Sunnybrook Hospital, where there's an opportunity for them to be doing experiments around dissolving the plaques that cause Alzheimer's. We are at such an important frontier that we should be mobilizing, not yielding. And the people who really do need to be at the forefront of this really are the people we're talking about. But aging is just a natural part of life for everyone, whether you're 2 years old, 5 years old, 85 or 90, we are all going to age. We've got to be more nimble. And it's how do we open the door for those conversations, have those conversations with decision makers and funders, but challenge the status quo and not see it as loss or as an end, but rather as an opportunity.
I think it's an opportunity and it's a positive evolution. I'm excited. And I'm not trying to be facile when I say this. I'm excited about the stuff we're doing in the field of aging. I think it's amazing and cutting edge. I think we're going to really, really take a chunk out of dementia in the next 10 years. I think that we are in many ways where HIV/AIDS was in the 90s. We are actually starting to understand a bit about dementia. We have our first treatments, like real treatments for it. Now, it's not perfect. It's not for everyone. But what is a perfect example of how we need to fix the system is, in order to get the treatments, you need certain scans. In order to get those scans, you have to have them available to you. If you don't get those scans, you can't get into the treatment. We have 7 to 10 years before a diagnosis of dementia as a standard. And that's kind of, I think, because no one wants to talk about it. People aren't really trying to get a diagnosis because it usually means that they lose things. They lose their license. They lose their decision-making power. They lose their social power because it's one of the most stigmatized things possible. And if there wasn't a treatment at the other end of that diagnosis, I understand why people don't try to get diagnosed, even if we could get diagnosed. But now, and in the next 0 to 5 years, now there's a pathway of hope, which means we need to clean up that system, which means we need to be thinking about these ways that we can make our systems work better. That also means that companies can play a really important role. Again, if you think that this is going to be government that solves all of our issues, I have a book for you to read, right? But if I can get companies on board, that means when I go grocery shopping, we have a lane that's helpful. We have people who can find their way who have dementia because they have more universal icons, which are also helping people with autism. That's great. I'm part of the Global Coalition on Aging, which is a combination of, yes, not-for-profits like mine, CanAge. And yes, some kind of quasi-government structures like the WHO and the UN, but mostly it's companies. Companies coming together to figure out actually how do you promote innovation in this space. It is incredibly exciting because when it becomes a thing that's like Amazon and Best Buy and I don't know, your phone company and wherever else, that's when you know that you've really got the wind under you.
So Laura, what you're telling us is there's more than 27 essential conversations.
There's a lot more. There's another couple books coming.
And on that note, Laura Tamblyn Watts, thank you for sharing 27 Essential Conversations. Thank you for this conversation.
And right back at you, these types of conversations make things less scary and help people think about where we live and what kind of help we need at different points of our life.
Thank you for listening to Coming of Age, the podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care and aging. We hope this episode brings a new perspective and inspires you to continue the conversation with your colleagues, friends, and family. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so that more listeners will join our community of changemakers in seniors care. Until next time, I'm your host, Donna Duncan. Keep well. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Point Click Care. Point Click Care is a leading healthcare technology platform enabling meaningful collaboration and access to real-time insights at any stage of a patient's healthcare journey. Point Click Care's single platform spans the care continuum, fostering proactive, holistic decision-making and improved outcomes for all. More than 25,000 long-term post-acute care providers and more than 1,600 hospitals use PointClick Care today. For more information on PointClick Care's software solutions, visit pointclickcare.com.